Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Hey, it's another Wildlife Wednesday, and who other than Scott Craven is back with us, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. We'll talk about fall hunting, talk about habitat conservation, maybe protecting public lands. And, of course, we will look forward to your outdoor observations. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. And we really would love to hear from you. So give a call or shoot an email over. Love to see or hear it. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, listeners. It's great to be back, and it's just a wonderful time of year, as you pointed out in the introduction, Larry. The weather's great. In fact, the weather's a little strange. We might talk about that a little bit, too. But from the wildlife perspective, this time of year is as good as it gets. It's fat city, so to speak, for wildlife. There's food and cover everywhere. The weather's still nice. It's a good time for all concerned.
It is indeed. This time of the year, I always like to take a trip over to Horicon Marsh. Great time to see the geese coming in, especially late in the day when they come in from feeding other places into the marsh. It's a sight to behold.
It is. And there are many such opportunities in Wisconsin this time of year.
We've got a number of hunting seasons underway already, and one is actually ending today already.
Well, there are a lot of things going on. This is October's kind of the highlight. As you point out, there have been seasons open already. The dove season and early goose and teal seasons were back on September 1st. And, of course, the big opening for the archery or bow and arrow or crossbow deer season was back in mid-September. But coming up here tomorrow, duck season in the southern zone opens. The youth deer hunt is a week from this weekend on the 11th and 12th. Rabbits, pheasants, grouse all open on the 18th up in or down here in Zone B in the Northwoods. Zone A is already open. And a lot of trapping seasons come online both on the 18th and more opportunities on the 25th. So the take-home message there, Larry, I think that I'd like to make clear to the listeners, especially those who hunt or trap, is that the hunting and trapping regulations have become much more complicated over the years, and that's out of necessity. But, again, the take-home message is that any hunter, trapper, or fisher, as you well know, must know where they are, the season dates, and all the pertinent harvest regulations, not only to be legal, but to increase their peace of mind and therefore their chances of success and enjoyment of the whole situation. So it pays to pay attention.
It does indeed. Bill in Oregon has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. I had the first-in-a-lifetime encounter for me of watching, seeing the end game of two hummingbirds going in a physical confrontation. So I've seen the battles many times where they rise up together face-to-face, and then they start engaging, and then they start dropping. And every time I've seen it before, they've always separated before you hit the ground. This time, they didn't.
So what happened?
Well, they bounced because, I mean, they did the normal thing, you know, where they're rising up together and then they came together and then they started dropping, and then there was a big flurry of feather, you know, there was a big flurry of wings right before they hit, and they bounced, and then they came to a stasis, and I believe I saw the end game because one hummingbird was beak down with its wings spread, and its body up behind it. The other one was just standing on its beak.
Oh my gosh!
Huh. Well, that certainly was taken further than I've ever seen it. But they're aggressive little buggers for the fact that they're about the size of a human thumb. They certainly do a lot of squabbling over rights to the hummingbird feeder or a preferred flower bed or whatever. But the one that was down and apparently submissive. Was it injured, or did you check it out, or did they eventually fly off?
I watched for several minutes, and I was at one point I was wondering if the one on top would, because it was literally just standing there and using its wings to balance. The other one was trying to take flight, but all it could do was rotate around its beak, because it couldn't lift the weight of the other hummingbird on its beak, and it was exhausting it slowly. And I was watching it, and it didn't. I was wondering if it would attack it, you know, or, you know, use its beak to damage its eyes, or, you know, or go after something. But it was just content standing there, and it seemed to be, and it didn't seem to have any inclination to leave. So I slowly started to walk over. I got about 2 feet away from him, and then the one that was on top lifted up and just scolded me for. It just spun around in a circle about 2 feet off the ground until I walked off, and the other one got the heck out of Dodge right away as soon as it was released.
Interesting.
Well, no harm, no foul, I guess, but that certainly has gone further than any confrontation I've ever seen. But it's not good from an evolutionary standpoint for those confrontations over territory, food, or whatever to end in physical harm. So apparently that one didn't. And anyway, neat story.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Bill. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to CWD testing for just a second. I know the DNR is encouraging deer hunters to submit samples for chronic wasting disease testing. And there's information out there on how to do it. They especially want, I think, central and northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, the priority areas are in central Wisconsin and then extending to the north, I think up into Vilas and Oneida counties. And those are areas where there have either been scattered cases or just haven't had particularly good coverage in the past. So, yes, you're right. And the ongoing battle against CWD testing is one of the things that people can do, I mean, hunters can do. And yeah, among other things, if people are still kind of equivocal about whether this is important or not, there was a really good article in the DNR Natural Resources magazine this past issue that just came out a few days ago. And it's really a summary of that big southwestern Wisconsin deer study that's been going on for years. And the title of the article is Study Tells the CWD Story. And it does talk about the data that they now have suggesting that survival rates are much, much lower for infected animals, and those are documented. And then it goes on to describe the threshold rates of infection, which is about 29% for adult female deer. If they're infected, then the local deer population is expected to decline, and they're starting to see that in some areas with high infection rates. So anyway, it goes on in that article to talk about what you can do to help. And of course, if you're a hunter, you can continue to hunt because that's the most powerful population management tool we have. But testing is right behind it as a valuable source of information that keeps track of how CWD is progressing. And then for the rest of the folks who are not actively hunting and therefore involved in population management or testing, it behooves everyone to be familiar with the disease and be familiar with the impacts of deer feeding and things like that that a lot more people are involved with. So anyway, it's still out there. There are a variety of ways to get your tests completed. There'll be kiosks scattered all over the state, and you can submit your samples either with the head or learning how with an educational video on the DNR website to remove the tissue that's important for testing and get that in, and that saves everybody a little trouble. But the bottom line, Larry, is this is all on the DNR website. You can search under CWD, find the location of testing sites, the protocols, and the instructions for how to do it correctly and move forward. But please, get your deer tested. It's in your own best interest, and it's certainly in the best interest of the deer herd.
Kathy in Greenleaf, we'll go to you now. Thank you, Kathy, for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hi. We live in the country on the edge of a heavily wooded ravine, and so right now at our beer treaters, and in fact, all year we have a gamut of squirrels and whatnot, but we've had three woodchucks that visit frequently, and the squirrels, the woodchucks, chipmunks, they're all after, you know, the sunflower seeds, the peanuts and whatnot. But my woodchucks for the past 3 weeks have not, probably 3 or 4 weeks, have not shown up. And they were daily visitors. Do they go into a hibernation earlier than other animals? Do they go to a different location? It's just strange because the one had a young pup last year, and they both overwintered in the vicinity because they were here very early in the spring. And she had another pup this year. And so we had the three of them, and then she chased off her pup from last year. But he would come back to get his peanuts every day. So what's going on as far as, do they move to a different location?
No, I don't think they've moved at all, but I think they've changed their behavior a bit. They're not hibernating yet. That's yet to come. And when they do, it will be in the extensive burrow system that they have excavated somewhere that they're using. But I think this goes back to my introductory comment that this is Fat City as far as wildlife is concerned or are concerned this time of year. There's a big acorn crop in most areas. Fruits of all types are falling to the ground. Crops are being harvested. There's food everywhere. And I think as the season has progressed here over the last month or so, I've noticed it even at my own feeding stations that the feeders are being cleaned out almost daily. And now I can go 3 or 4 days without having to fill the feeders. There's food everywhere, and the animals are taking advantage of natural food sources that they may find more palatable or more normal, more nutritious or whatever, and they're taking advantage of this now, whereas early in the spring, your feeders were the only game in town until plants began to mature and bear fruit and that kind of thing. So I think there's always the possibility that some type of harm has befallen them, but I think that's a long shot in this case. I think this is just a redirection of their feeding behavior to take advantage of what's available. And if you either wait it out, whether they'll revert back to the feeders or not before they go into hibernation remains to be seen. But my suspicion is that come next spring, your woodchucks will be back under the feeder. So
there you go, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor and UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Tom in River Falls, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for our speaker today. How soon will it be that the DNR will develop a CWD test that hunters can administer as soon as they harvest their deer to know if that deer has CWD? An instant result.
Yeah.
Well, I share your pain in asking for that. I've always been an avid deer hunter, and I've worked closely with CWD since the day it was discovered. And I think everyone involved has known that a rapid test, like a piece of litmus paper you could put on the deer's tongue and all of a sudden, oh, it turned blue, the deer's sick or whatever, would be a game changer. As far as hunters' response and responsibility, it would just be a game changer. but it has not happened. There have been, it's not just here in Wisconsin, there are people working on this all over the country, wherever CWD has been discovered, and that's just about everywhere now. A lot of people have worked on it, but nothing has happened on that front. Well, I think progress has been made, but in answer to your basic question, when is it going to happen? I don't know. No one else knows, but there are a whole lot of people with their fingers crossed that it will happen someday. That's about all I can tell you.
Yeah. Tom, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Just to kind of get back to CWD in a way, there are baiting and feeding bans in 62 of our 72 counties, if I'm not mistaken. It's like only, where we hunt, Bayfield is still open to feeding, but there are only 10 counties that that allow it. And the reason, Scott?
Well, the reason is because one of the main transmission routes for chronic wasting disease is bodily fluids passed between deer when they're in close proximity. And feeding stations, that doesn't mean they aren't close together. If you see a herd of deer milling around in the woods, yes, they're close together. They may be close together in a cornfield, but on a feed pile, on where someone's dumped out a bucket of corn or whatever, I mean, they're right there together. And as they're jostling with each other for position on the feed pile or whatever, then there's an increased probability that there's transmission of fluids and increased probability that the disease can be spread that way. And so the basic premise here is that if feeding facilitates the spread of chronic wasting disease, then cease and desist on feeding is, or baiting for that matter, is a good thing and is a desirable thing. And that's why when a county comes up with a CWD positive, that county and adjacent counties enter into the feeding ban. And I think it's still set that it extends for 3 years or continues if additional positives are discovered. So it's strictly how much good it does, I don't know, and I'm not sure anybody really knows. But it's in a situation where there seems to be precious little that we can do to stem the spread of this disease, I guess it goes under the old saying, every little bit helps. So,
yep. There you go. We have a question from an email from Dan, who wants to know, what's the latest news on Wisconsin elk herds? Are they healthy? Wouldn't it be exciting to see elk range throughout the state?
The bottom line is the elk herds are doing well, both the northern and the central Wisconsin herds, and that whole program is progressing nicely. But you may recall that back when they were first reintroduced in 1995, there was considerable concern over whether they would essentially stay put. The areas were selected with good reason. The range was suitable. The densities of people and agriculture and so forth were conducive to the presence of elk. And so that's where they were released, with the hope that they would expand but stay in that general area. Because, of course, the concern was this is a large animal, essentially a huge deer, so to speak. And if they started meandering well out of their range where they were placed or released, then there was greater potential for problems, meaning crop depredations, animal vehicle collisions, and assorted other things that we already know we have with the deer herd. So they were released with the intent of establishing herds where the herds have established, and there's not a whole lot of interest in seeing them expand even greatly in those areas geographically and certainly not statewide. So it sounds good on paper. They're majestic animals. Their behaviors are neat to watch. They're spectacular for photo ops and of course, hunting opportunity, but it's a good thing they are where they are, and we should be grateful that they are.
Bill in Fond du Lac emailed to say they were walking along the edge of a farm field on Sunday evening and watched a flock of geese rise up out of the recently chopped off cornfield, and one goose struggled to lift off and appeared to have a bad leg and couldn't run to get flight. It struggled into a ditch. Bill didn't pursue it, but felt bad about not trying to help it. They said they got nowhere calling DNR on Monday. What could Bill have done to help the goose?
Probably nothing. Even an incapacitated, what seems to be an incapacitated bird, whether it's a bad leg, broken wing, or whatever, is still pretty mobile. And they're not easy to catch. And even if it were captured, it's not something that could be, you know, held by an individual. It would have to be taken to a rehabilitator, a wildlife rehabilitator, if you could find one. But that's a pretty involved activity. I understand the feeling badly about it, because when I worked at Horicon as a graduate student and we were banding thousands of geese and were operating there daily, every daylight hour during the hunting season, it was common for my crew and I to encounter considerable numbers of birds that were injured, presumably from gunfire, although in this case it may have been something else. But in any event, injured birds, broken wings, broken legs, whatever. And we actually got to the point where we were capturing those birds, and we had a big pen available on the refuge, and we were putting them in there, and they accumulated rather rapidly, and we fed them and gave them a shot. If they recovered to the point where it appeared they could fly, we'd let them go. And those that recovered but were incapacitated were in those years, we managed to find city parks and communities. Oh, we'd like some geese. Now, those days are largely over because everybody's got geese, and in most cases, way more than they need. But that was our response, and I understand it's normal human activity to feel some empathy for an animal that it cannot get off the ground and take off with its colleagues. But how do I want to word this? It's all of these animals in a flock of geese, of the hundreds of thousands that will be at Horicon, there's constant mortality, whether it's due to hunting or predators or injury, fly into a power line or whatever. It happens, and it's part of a goose being a goose, and there's very little that we can do about it. And you just have to take a deep breath and say, boy, that's unfortunate, but it's very unlikely that I can intervene successfully, and go about your business and wish the bird well and see what happens.
We had, I don't know if you can see the photo, Johnny emailed us from Belleville. Between Belleville and New Glarus, a photo of an animal, pretty good photo of it. I thought it was a bobcat. And as I look at it, I think it might well be a bobcat.
Well, it probably is a bobcat, because they have been extending their range and activity further south along the Driftless area, from western Wisconsin further and further south through the Driftless area and into most parts of southwestern Wisconsin now, including over toward the Dane County area, or Rock County, Lafayette County, Iowa County, and so forth. So numerous bobcats turned up during that southwestern deer study that we have talked about, and sightings have become commonplace. So my guess is that's exactly what it is, and it's neat to have them around. But
yeah,
we'll just add that to the database.
Mary from Ladysmith emailed to ask why some deer who are in a mishap along the road are not consumed by other animals or birds. Could it be because of CWD?
I Probably not. In terms of if what she means is, does another scavenger come along and say, "Whoa, I'm not eating that thing. It's got CWD." That's not the case. In various studies that took place after CWD was discovered, carcasses were consumed without regard for what the researchers knew, whether they were infected or whether they weren't. The scavengers take advantage of a food source. If they're, and most of what you see along the roadside is eventually worked on by everything from vultures to eagles and whatever mammalian scavengers can get at them. But I think what you see is a reluctance to, for some of the animals that are reasonably secretive, whether it's coyotes or wolves or what have you, that they're not very happy about being right along the roadside where there's traffic and human activity. So if it seems like they stay there a long time, part of that's the reluctance of scavengers to go after them. And part of it's that they need to sit there for a while before things like vultures and other things can actually open them up and feed on the carcasses. So, yeah, but there's no, as far as anyone knows, or as far as I know, there's no capability of a scavenger detecting this thing's sick or doesn't smell good or whatever. It's a pile of food, and those kinds of human sensibilities don't enter into the equation.
Yeah. It does remind me, though, about the car-deer collision that occurred in Lafayette County, and you're probably aware of that.
Yeah, I read about that one, too, and it's that's an unfortunate situation, and it's one of the things I wanted to be sure we mentioned, that deer vehicle collisions are going to ramp up here with the increasing rate of crop fields being harvested and therefore removing some habitat, with the increased deer movement as we approach the rut and breeding season, and just the fact that this is a near peak in when the deer population peaks out after fawn drop in June and going into the harvest season. There's a lot of deer out there on the landscape, and they're more active as the weather cools down and for those other factors I just mentioned. So the bottom line is, be careful driving, especially in low light conditions in early morning and evening, and watch out for deer. The accident that you referred to in Lafayette County occurred at, I think, 11 o'clock in the morning. So it can happen at any time when deer are on the move. And that was a motorcycle, by the way, and the driver sustained serious injuries. But people are killed every year in Wisconsin in deer vehicle collisions. Thousands of deer are killed, and there's millions of dollars in damage caused to vehicles. So it behooves everybody to slow down a little bit in areas where they know there are high deer populations, and as deer activity ramps up, those deer crossing signs that are put up with something in mind, meaning there is a history of collisions in that area, or it's a particularly good corridor for deer movement. So be careful out there.
Be careful out there. Scott Craven, our guest today. If you have a question, I hope you'll join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Or maybe you've got an observation. You can also email us to talk@wpr.org. And I did want to mention in the last half hour of the show today, we're going to turn our attention to some UW research from Scott's home department on how antibiotics in our waters are affecting frogs and amphibians. So that'll be later on, one of the last last segment of our program. Ellie in Middleton emailed to say there's a family of sparrows in the gutter of their home. When can Ellie safely kick them out to clean the gutters this fall? She doesn't want to be mean.
Well, I guess I'd go up and inspect the situation. It's pretty late in the season for any bird to actually be nesting or nesting successfully. If there is, in fact, a nest and a really late clutch, then it's a matter of trying to assess if there are fledglings, for example. You know, maybe there's a couple weeks. It depends on what everything was initiated. but I think they're probably just up there rummaging around, looking for something in what's accumulated in the gutter, and especially with sparrows, or maybe they're house finches, but anyway, let's assume they're sparrows, which are an invasive species. If they were in my gutter, they would have been evicted a few minutes ago. So I think it's a matter of cleaning things up, and the sparrows may go on their way. If, in fact, there's a nest, which would be pretty unusual, then it's a matter of giving them a little time, clean out the rest of the gutters, and if you're so inclined, leave them alone until the young fledge, and once they have, then clean up and be done for the winter. And that leads us into hopefully talking a little later about yard and garden cleanup before winter, but we'll get to that.
We will get to that. And it sounds a little early anyway, Ellie, to be cleaning out your gutters, especially if you've still got trees with leaves on them. But be that as it may, let's turn to Steve in Verona. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Scott and Larry. My question is, how do squirrels keep their dray or their nest together? I've seen them running around in the fall with a mouthful of leaves. I've seen some of those up in a tree, and it lasts all winter long. One was suspended right over the highway or the main road in Verona, and it lasted come spring. It just disappears. And they're not all that big, and they say they can crawl in there and they can snuggle up. That means they need a hole to go in, and the whole thing has to be held together kind of rigidly. How smart are they, and what are they doing to hold that together?
I'm not sure it's smart or intelligence is kind of a human construct, but any of these animals that construct a nest or a housing unit have that's an innate characteristic. They know how to do that innately. They're not necessarily trained by watching parents or what have you. Now, you've picked out the squirrel nest, but that big mass, ugly looking, kind of awkward mass of leaves, you think, wow, that's not much of a nest. But think to some other species that construct, like the mud nest of a swallow or virtually any bird nest. That's a feat of engineering that if I gave you a bucket of mud, a bucket of sticks, and some thread and yarn, and said, here, make a nest, it would not come out anywhere near as efficient and streamlined and functional as what these animals are capable of doing. So they know what they're doing, and it's a matter of weaving things in. First of all, site selection and the crotch or fork of a tree that has a solid foundation, and then working from that, starting with some small twigs and leaves and working up a mouthful at a time, as you described, until they've got something workable. And how they do it, I can't tell you, but they know what they're doing. And the nests, despite the fact that they look pretty rickety, do the job and hold up in wind and storms and everything else. Not all of them do. Some are blown down. Some squirrels are probably better than others at it. But they do stand the test of time, and they work. And squirrels continue to use them.
They do indeed, Steve. I observed, I may have talked about this on the show once, I observed in the fall, about this time of the year, a squirrel in sort of a little wooded area moving three of her baby, you know, her young, from one nest to another tree with another nest that she had made. And the baby squirrel would wrap its arms and legs and so forth around the belly of the mother. And the mother would, one at a time, move them over not that far away to the new nest, one at a time. And it was quite a long, involved process, and sure fun to watch.
And Larry, I guess the other point is that the drays, which is the kind of the technical name for what the squirrels do with a leaf nest, are usually created. A given squirrel will have a number of those within its territory, and they're usually used for quick escape from predators, weather, or what have you, or for temporary shelter. In terms of in terms of holing up for the winter, so to speak, or having young, that's usually a matter of seeking out a tree cavity, a nest box, or something that they excavate that's a little more solid and enduring and provides more shelter than the leaf nets does. But they do serve a purpose.
Scott, in early September, the Boone and Crockett Club released the finding of a research project on poaching. And maybe we could talk about it. First, maybe talk about what is the Boone and Crockett Club. It's a fair chase hunting organization, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a hunting organization. They were formed, and of course, the name Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett was taken to recognize two famous historical figures. But they're best known, I guess, for maintaining the record books for trophy animals that if you shoot a huge deer or whatever, then of course the goal is that might make the Boone and Crockett record books. So you sometimes hear them mention that context, but they also function as a conservation organization, doing lots more than just maintaining those records. They have a scholarship program for college natural resources and wildlife students. They do research, and in this case, they sponsored a research program to try and get a handle on the amount of poaching going on in this country and its impact. And there have been a number of such studies over time. I used to refer to one when I was actively working that was, I think, done in Michigan many years ago, that suggested that the probability of apprehension or of stopping a poaching event was about 2%. And so Boone and Crockett wanted to update this whole thing and do a program or conduct a research project that was kind of a synthesis of everything we knew about poaching and what it meant. And when all was said and done, and they did the literature searches, interviews with poachers, interviews with law enforcement, interviews with different states and what they were finding, they came up with a so-called probability of apprehension or incidence of 4%. Not much of an increase over the years from what we used to talk about. So the bottom line here is that this is a big deal, because essentially poaching is equated with theft. What's going on here is that our wildlife resources are being stolen by people who are taking them illegally. And there's some cost involved in that. In addition to the loss of animals, which means for every bull elk or buck white-tailed deer that's taken in a poaching incident, that's one less such animal for legal hunters, people who are abiding by the rules, to have an opportunity to harvest. That's one issue. The other aspect, if poaching is going largely undetected, the lost fines that are forfeited or the costs of restitution or reestablishing those lost wildlife in terms of a population impact has a tremendous economic impact. So this has been getting a lot of attention since the study was released in Washington just a short time ago. And most notably in the Outdoor News publication, there was a very well prepared and written commentary written by the editor of the Hunting Wire, which is an outdoor publication. His name was Pinsky, and he did a very thoughtful summary. And I'm just going to read a couple of things that I highlighted out of this, because I was very depressed with the content, but very impressed with the way it was reported. So what this project revealed, and it was called the Poach and Pay Project, only 4% of the incidents are detected. Roughly translated, that means that for each poacher caught, 24 walk away free. For every elk or turkey or whatever that's poached, 24 out of 25 of those thieves disappear. No consequence. Terrible situation. The cost of that I mentioned a moment ago, and uncollected fines and replacement costs, is estimated at about $1.4 billion a year. That's more than we collect for conservation from the Pittman-Robertson funds, and we've talked about those before.
Yeah.
This is a big deal, and I think the most important take-home message for me is that, I mean, it's not petty crime, and hunters really need to, as he described in this editorial, hunters need to shout this out from the rooftops. Poachers aren't hunters. Hunting is legal. Hunting is ethical. Hunting funds conservation in many ways. But poaching is theft, plain and simple. Yeah. Now, the motivations tell the tale here. Through the survey, about 58% of poaching is driven by trophy hunting. The remaining 51% is opportunistic. You know, somebody who's out in the fields are, oh, my God, the ducks are really flying today and there's nobody around. I guess I will take 10 or 15 instead of the 3 or 4 I'm allowed. In other words, there was no premeditation. Yeah. The important thing, or one of the important messages for me, is that subsistence poaching, you know, we think about somebody who's, they live in the country and they don't have enough money for groceries, so they pop a deer to feed the family. That type of poaching barely even registers in the data. So the fact that it's driven by trophy hunting or ignorant opportunistic behavior, he describes as acts of arrogance, greed, and defiance. It's really a depressing state of affairs. Our wardens are critically important, but there's too few of them, and they have too much to do. They can't do it alone. So the take-home message is everybody should take some personal responsibility here. Report poaching whenever you see it. Silence enables poaching, and active reporting goes a long way towards stopping it. And this involves, you know, youth education and hunter education. It involves just somebody who's out driving around and sees something that looks suspicious, or somebody who lives in the country and hears gunfire in the middle of the night. Report that. It's everybody's responsibility.
Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor in the UW Extension Wildlife Ecology area. It's great to have him back with us. And we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Paul in Lincoln County has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Paul. Oh, I think we lost Paul. Let's go to Robert in Wausau then. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's the first time I've ever called into a show, but I had a quick related a story about CWD, and I'd like your comment, and then a quick question. My story is I have some property in Southwest Marathon County, and a few years ago I was notified that by the DNR that there was a wild positive, and they issued me 2 tags. They wanted landowners to go out and harvest a couple more deer for sampling. There's nearby a fenced deer breeding and enclosed hunting facility or place where people go and shoot trophy deer in the fenced area. And I asked how many positives they had, and the DNR representative couldn't answer that, but gave me a contact for the Department of Agriculture, which apparently regulates all these deer farms. So I talked to that contact, and he told me at the time that they had 115 positives, which was quite hard to imagine. And I think that place is still in existence, so I'd be curious about a comment. And then my question is, I had read somewhere that in Michigan a couple years ago, they had a study where the prion for CWD was found to be taken up into plant material and from the ground, and that was also a potential mode of transmission. And I wonder if there's any more information about that as an environmental contaminant. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Scott?
Well, both of those are excellent observations and points. I mean, one of the, when you mentioned earlier, Larry, about the number of counties that had feeding bans because of CWD prevalence, especially in some of the central and northern counties, these hot spots, as they're called, are associated with deer farms or deer breeding operations or high fence operations for hunting. And there have been a number of cases where when they discover this and actually go into the farm and do the sampling, the incidents, I mean, it's almost like all deer are sick. The prevalence rate is extremely high, and that's why it's critically important that these operations remain fenced or double fenced. And there are stipulations on how that has to be done in the regulations for captive animals. And the caller was right. Once these animals are under fence, so to speak, they become the purview of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, much like any other livestock. Not the DNR's issue, but the DNR is forced to deal with the consequences of these pockets of infection, including doing intensive sampling around them like the caller was asked to do by taking a couple of additional deer. It's a big problem in CWD management, but on these operations, which are privately held businesses essentially, it's not easy to just go in there and say, hey, you've got an infection. These animals need to be all put down. And this has led to court cases and all sorts of delays and battles. So it's an ongoing problem. And I'm pleased to hear the caller bring it to our attention as being another complication in the whole management of CWD. In terms of the prions, the misfolded proteins that are the root cause of the disease being taken up by plants, that information's been around for a while, but I don't know that it's ever been documented that a case, and I don't know how we would actually, that a case, a transmission case has been traced to that means of acquisition of the prion leading to infection. I don't know of any pen studies, for example, where deer were fed plant material where either the prion had been detected or there was some suspicion that it was, to see if those deer became sick. I don't think that's been done, and I don't think that's considered a major form of transmission compared to deer fluids, bodily contact, or whatever. But I don't know about that. I think a little bit of a Google search might turn up some more information in that regard.
We have Ann and Schmidt. Ann and Schmidt emailed to say they live in northern Marquette and their friend lives in western Greene County. They're both seeing fawns so young they still have spots, wondering why they were born so late in the season.
Well, I mean, the birth of fawns, like any other natural event, is not just a, you know, it starts on July 1 and it's all over July 10th, so to speak. It's a normal distribution, a bell curve, so to speak, of births from early breedings, late breedings. And as a result, I remember one report from a call I got that a woman called and said, say, I have two newborn fawns in my tulips. And it was Easter weekend in April, you know, way, way early. Similarly, reports like this one that just came in that, hey, there's some little spotted fawns out here. That's just either the right-hand tail or the left-hand tail of the distribution of births. So a doe that came into heat or estrus late gets bred or late in the season, and all of a sudden the births are very late. So it happens, and it happens.
Scott Craven will be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your questions, and I hope you'll join in. We are going to take a quick break, take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back. I am Larry Mueller. Great to have you along on this Wildlife Wednesday. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, retired UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Shane in, it was near Appleton. Shane, hi.
Hi. I live in Calumet County, about a 10-minute drive from High Cliff State Park, which is outside of Appleton, so I'm kind of in a weird area. But a few months ago, I saw a vulture in a field while driving home. And I've lived here my entire life, and I've never seen a vulture, and my mom has lived here over 50 years, and she doesn't remember ever seeing a vulture. And 2 days ago, there were two vultures in my backyard neighbor's barn, or perched on my backyard neighbor's barn. And I was shocked, but I was excited because vultures are my favorite bird of prey. But I was wondering, because we've never seen them here before, are they supposed to be this far out close to Lake Winnebago? And I'm also wondering, as they pass through, or if they're here to stay, how we can be good neighbors to the vultures.
Well, first of all, it's a fun observation. And if you enjoy seeing vultures, the good news is they're a relatively common sight in Wisconsin. And I don't know that I can't think of a day that goes by sitting here at my home south of Madison that I don't have vultures circling around on the thermals over my property. They're that common. And especially around High Cliff, they tend to like areas with rocky outcrops that they can sit, rest on, nest in, or whatever. They're common sight along the roadways, scavenging. And in terms of being good neighbors, there's not a great deal that you can do other than sit back and enjoy watching them if that's what you like. I wouldn't recommend necessarily trying to put out food for them or that kind of thing. If they're there, they're there for a reason, and they're going to be there, and enjoy them for what they are. But they're a reasonably common sight, certainly more so in some parts of the state than others, but everybody should have an opportunity to see them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean they're a big bird, and they're pretty obvious in the way they fly. Their wings are tipped up a little bit, so their soaring distinguishes them from some the eagles, hawks, and things like that. But just be observant, and I think you may find that you see them more than you thought you were going to.
So. Yeah, and Shane, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Rick in Portage County, we'll go to you. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered about the acorn crop around the rest of the state. In our forest here, we're almost all white and black oak. And at one point here, they've pretty much quit now, but I considered wearing a hard hat. I mean, there are so many acorns. Like, was it 2 years ago that we had such a bumper crop? This approaches that. I mean, they're in piles in the woods. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that's a question probably better answered by more callers calling in from different parts of the state, but I can only speak for my two areas. Where I live here at south of Madison, it's a great acorn crop. And where I have a cabin up in Price County, there's an even better acorn crop. And they seem to be all over the place. So it was constant rat-a-tat-tat on the roof as we were at the cabin a week or so ago. So it's a good acorn crop, and that goes back to my speaking about life is good right now for wildlife that depends on wild production of food and also the harvest season for farmers. So, yes, there are a lot of acorns, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I observed them as well in your neck of the woods last week, Scott. They were just getting peppering us in the woods, wooded areas. Yeah. It was fun. Oh, man. Thanks a lot for calling, Rick. Appreciate it. Don in Iron River, your turn. Hi, Don.
Say, Monday, I saw a wild turkey. He must have a broken leg. He was gimping around, and he settled down for 5 hours, 50 yards from my front door, and he tried to roost, and he couldn't. He flew in the tree. He couldn't land. He landed, but he couldn't keep his balance. And then Tuesday, I saw him with his turkey clan. They were walking back in the woods, and I think he was trying to keep up with him, or they were trying to keep up with him.
And he was, okay. And Don was wondering what happened, you know, wonder what would happen to that turkey, and probably not good things.
Well, probably not good things, but as we talked about, you know, with other species, with other callers over the show and other shows, accidents do befall wild animals just like they befall humans. Unfortunately, on the wild animal side, they can't seek their own medical intervention, so it's kind of the let the chips fall where they may. And an animal that's debilitated by some injury is more prone to something basically finishing it off, whether it's a predator or starvation or some other thing that we'd rather not think about. So it happens. It's not pleasant to think about, but it has to be accepted as part of the natural cycle. All of these animals can't survive and live to a ripe old age and, you know, die peacefully. It just doesn't work that way. And what fate befell this particular turkey, I don't know. But on the bright side, many of these animals, most of these animals are incredibly tough and can survive and heal up from injuries that would just put a human out of action. And as a result, you see cases where animals are later perhaps taken by hunters or in some other way examined, and there's the evidence of an injury that, how the heck did this ever heal, or how did the animal survive? But it does happen. So when you witness something like this, I would think positive thoughts, and hopefully the animal survives, heals up, and goes on about its life, even though it may limp or fly poorly or whatever, but it's able to survive. Some do, some don't.
Yeah.
Don, that's the way it is.
Thanks for calling, Don. Gianni in Montello, your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, a great show, Scott and Larry. Listen, please forgive the cynic in me, but my question concerns the introduction to elk in Wisconsin. Given the number of deer collisions that we see throughout the state, and that number seems to be growing, aren't we asking for more even serious fatal collisions between cars and elk in the future as the herd grows? And could the herd spread throughout Wisconsin? Again, my cynicism says they were introduced because the DNR wants more management funding. There's just more money going to come their way if they have an additional species like elk in Wisconsin. Where am I going wrong?
Well, I think the original plan for the introduction, and there were a number of species considered for reintroduction, and some were rejected, but elk are so popular nationally because they are big, spectacular animals. They have interesting breeding behaviors, spectacular antlers. They have a lot of things going for them. So yes, it was possible and always considered possible that they would provide some recreational hunting, and they now do, but it's very limited, limited to 8 or 10 permits a year, and those are highly coveted and sought after. So I don't believe it's ever likely to become a major hunting enterprise. So the revenue for the DNR isn't in the cards, but they're also a tourist attraction. People like to be around in the fall when the male elk, the bulls are bugling, and just to see them, so that there's some economic benefit there. But I think the original motivation was they were a native species that had been extirpated for a variety of reasons or factors. And the DNR has always been interested in restoring animals that were lost from our fauna. The trumpeter swans are a great example, and they're doing very well now. Everybody's happy about that. And animals that almost became extirpated, whether they were bald eagles that reached low numbers or common loons or peregrine falcons or whatever, and there are many successful programs to keep those animals thriving. And so that's good. The elk situation was an example of bringing an extirpated animal back into the state. And as we talked about, there was great consideration given to where they would be released and could they be released in an area where they were likely to stay rather than spreading throughout the area where they were put up around Clam Lake or down in central Wisconsin. And the good news is they have stayed put. The herd is not growing or expanding rapidly, but they're doing well, and they're providing the benefits that were hoped for, and they're part of our native fauna again. So I don't think you've missed anything. It's just that the good news is that they have stayed put because there was great concern when they were reintroduced. Well, what if these things start moving around? They're going to be a vehicle collision risk. They're going to be a crop depredation threat. They'll cause problems. But that has not materialized, and the animals are basically where they were supposed to be. So that's the long and short of it.
Jenny, thank you for calling. Laura in central Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Laura.
Oh, hey, guys. I actually have some pretty good news. I was just driving through Nisida and looked over into the wildlife area, and I saw a flock of whooping cranes there in the fields. So that's always great to see. And I guess my question is, how are the cranes, the whooping cranes, doing this year, if you know? And when do they start to migrate?
Well, let's say how they're doing first. So the whooping cranes, that the focus of all this is, of course, the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, and the restoration of the eastern population, which was done with the ultralight aircraft and so forth. And those birds are surviving and doing fairly well. I think that population, if I remember correctly, is up around mid-70s somewhere in terms of numbers. There was a fair bit of publicity recently because one of the young whoopers that was doing well in Horican Marsh I think it was avian flu, potentially from wild waterfowl, and died just recently. And of course, when one bird out of a potential flock of less than 100, there's a percentage represented there. So that caused some consternation. But otherwise, other than that bit of bad news, they're doing pretty well, and they continue to do well. And the Crane Foundation continues to monitor that, and they have the protection and management support that they need. So I think overall, the news on the whooping crane front is pretty good.
Yeah, I think so as well. Laura, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Doug emailed. He thinks a lot of people love to blame low deer counts on an imbalance of predators to prey. He's wondering which has more impact on the deer population, wolf kills or vehicle strikes?
Well, that's sort of an apples and oranges thing, Larry, because the wolf depredation are localized in the northern part of the state, whereas deer vehicle collisions are statewide, so there's no directly comparable numbers. Where the wolves tend to flourish in areas of low road densities and lower humid densities, there's not the opportunity for vehicular collisions that there is elsewhere. So both are a drain on the deer population, but rather than focus on the deer vehicle collisions, the other predators that he is alluding to are black bears with their intensive predation on, particularly on fawns for a short period in the year. So the whole thing is pretty complicated. There are always, with any animal species or population, a number of drains or mortality factors involved. whether it's predation, vehicle collisions, disease, and a whole host of other things. And trying to sort that all out and then have it make sense in specific or smaller areas is very complicated.
We're going to be talking about whooping cranes next Wednesday on the show. So just point out a little promotion there.
Well, anyway, people like to attach some certainty to why we have low deer numbers in various places or why we don't, and that's not an easy thing to do.
We have a question on public lands. There's more than 60 communities in the western U.S. officially oppose the sale of public land to private interests. The emailer is wondering, what is happening out west to public parks and conservation areas?
Well, the fundamental problem, Larry, and I think we're a ways away from it, so people aren't either very aware of it or perhaps unconcerned, but I think the potential sale or distribution of some public lands in the western states, largely initiated by the federal government for whatever reason, some of it seems to be potential development, revenue generation, or whatever, is in my opinion, a dangerous precedent and a dangerous threat. It goes along with a couple of old sayings, you know, land, they're not making any more of it. And land that's in public ownership, once it's taken out of public ownership, is never coming back. And therefore, at least from my perspective, anything that erodes our public land base is not a good thing. There may be cases of landlocked parcels or whatever, or small parcels where, okay, it makes some sense. But general elimination of status of lands as public monuments, parks, or what have you, I think is a dangerous threat, and it's something that we all should be a little bit concerned about, or at least well-informed. It's public land, meaning whether you live in Utah or Wyoming or Colorado or whatever, does not mean that that land is any more yours for use or activity or ownership than it is for us sitting here in Wisconsin. It's the old song lyrics, you know, this land is your land, this land is my land. And I just think it's ill-advised to be liquidating these assets that we'll never get back.
Yeah. Well, public land in Wisconsin is protected in part from money from the Cherish Wisconsin Outdoors Fund, if I'm not mistaken.
It's not so much the protection as it is the management. I mean, we have a lot of public land, state-owned public land, and in parks and wildlife areas and natural areas and so forth, but there's relatively little funding for actually doing things on that land to deal with invasive species, trail management, and any number of other management activities. So the Cherish Fund was put into place a number of years ago. You can make a donation when you purchase a hunting or fishing license, or you can donate directly to the fund. But the milestone that was just reached was the fund surpassed $3 million, which is an important benchmark, and it continues to grow as an endowment, and it's managed by the Natural Resources Foundation, and that board parcels out revenue from the fund it's a grant program, basically, for proposals to deal with invasive species at site X and build a new trail at site Y, and those funds are then used to better manage and take care of our public lands. So this is another thing when people say, hey, what can I do to help with conservation or the outdoor situation here in Wisconsin? The Cherish Fund is one of those examples. The aforementioned report, poaching or illegal activity, whenever you have the opportunity, don't clean up your yard quite as much this fall as you might otherwise, because some of those plant stems and dead flower heads are important to pollinators over time. There are all sorts of little things like that that individuals like you and I can do that in the long run benefits conservation and the wildlife populations and outdoors that we all think highly of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in our last couple of minutes, we've got some questions, email questions. Stephen Platterville called to ask how common albino deer are in our state.
Fairly common in some areas. There are parts of the North Woods, for example, up around Boulder Junction, that are known for their white deer, and they're not common anywhere, but they're well known in some areas and commonly seen, although in absolute numbers they pale in comparison to normal deer. And then, of course, is the issue, are white deer or piebald deer, which are part white and part their normal brownish or grayish. So there are piebald deer, albino deer, and then there are leucistic deer that are white but don't have the pink eyes and other characteristics of albinism. So they're out there. They're a curiosity. There's always a little contention about whether it's legal to hunt them or not, and some regulations changes proposed, but I think they're just a curiosity of nature, and for somebody who gets to see one, great photo opportunity, something to talk about, but they're more common, particularly north, than they are down here.
And Mary emailed to say they spotted a fisher in Dunn County, north of Menominee, got a very good look at him because he had trouble getting out of Mary's fenced-in yard. Very dark brown and almost black, very long furry tail and healthy looking and beautiful. And certainly there would be fisher in Dunn County.
Yes, fisher got a lot of attention a few years ago, but it seems like one of those animals, when they're reintroduced, they became relatively abundant and maybe overshot the mark a little bit, and their population's a little retrenched, but they're around over most of the northern two-thirds of the state, and a neat animal to see.
Definitely a neat animal to see. And always neat talking with you, Scott. Thanks a lot.
Well, I'm sorry I got so wound up about poaching a little while ago, but that's that's an important issue and something that people need to think about. So anyway, get out there and enjoy the fall.
Always fun talking with you, Scott. Thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, comes by about every other month. David Drake and Jamie Knack from the department come by the other opposite month of him. But it's always fun to have them with us here on WPR News. Coming up next, we have another Wildlife Ecology Associate to visit with us. Jessica was going to talk about amphibians that are susceptible to harm from antibiotics making their way into our wetlands. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to antibiotic drugs and amphibians next. Antibiotics, of course, are prescribed to people to treat and prevent bacterial infections. But a lot of those antibiotics eventually wind up in the environment and can harm and do harm amphibians and other wildlife. We'll talk about the research going on and the impact of antibiotic pollution on frogs and why that matters with Jess Wah. Jess is an associate professor in UW-Madison's Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, leads the Wah Lab, where she leads a team of researchers studying ecosystem disturbances, like how pollution can affect ecology and evolution. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts and questions. You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jess, good to have you back.
Oh, thank you for having me, Larry.
Well, you study pollution of ecosystems, particularly how amphibians are impacted. And why are they so susceptible to pollutants?
Yeah, amphibians are incredibly susceptible to many pollutants in aquatic ecosystems because their skin is highly permeable. And so a lot of the pollutants can penetrate the skin, and this can be... Often people think about amphibians as a canary in the coal mine. So once pollutants get in, amphibians are often, because of how sensitive they are, the first to experience some of the negative consequences.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I think we have 55 species of reptiles and amphibians in the state. And quite a lot of them are at risk, are they not?
Yeah, amphibians, unfortunately, are the most threatened vertebrate taxa. Out of all vertebrates, amphibians are the top. In Wisconsin, there are 12 species of frogs and toads, and there are many efforts throughout the state to understand where these amphibians are and what factors, including pollutants and disease, might be contributing to some of their declines.
Yeah, and just thinking about it, I think about half of the species of reptiles and amphibians are endangered or at risk.
That's right. And this is a study that just came out in 2024. And I think it raises awareness in how much, not only that they're in danger, but how important they are to our ecosystem and also to human communities.
And there's other threats. There's habitat loss. I imagine there's some illegal pet trade going on.
Sure, yeah, and that contributes a lot to some of the spread of disease. And also, these multiple causes make it incredibly difficult to understand what might be driving and how complex this issue is and causing these declines.
Yeah, you got road collisions, you got climate change, all kinds of things going on. And here we are with this particularly deadly fungal disease. I think it's in frogs and salamanders.
That's right.
Chytrid, is it?
Chytrid, yes.
Chytrid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we also call it BD.
BD, okay. Mm-hmm, yes. Chytrid or BD.
That's
so
right.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a fungal disease that infects the keratinized tissue of the skin. And amphibians rely a lot on skin for breathing, for osmoregulation. And so when this fungus infects this keratinized tissue, what it does is it causes the skin to harden. And as it hardens, it thickens or it thins, and it makes it hard for amphibians to breathe, to regulate water. And in many amphibian species throughout the world, this leads to mortality.
And this has been documented in our state, actually in the Midwest.
Yes, that's correct. Some of the work that my lab has done recently, in particular in collaboration with the Center for Limnology, we've been surveying Madison ponds throughout Dane County, and we have detected BD in the mouth parts of amphibians here.
Around the mouth parts?
Yes, the mouth parts of tadpoles in particular, because in tadpoles, the only keratinized tissue is in the mouth parts. And for these tadpoles in particular, this can be harmful because it causes deformities in their mouths, and so they can't eat. And when they can't eat, this can also have cascading consequences on the rest of the ecosystem. It can affect the amount of algae in the system that might compete with blue-green algae. So there are a lot of consequences, and this is why we care about amphibians. In addition to how amazing they are, they also serve important ecosystem processes for the ecosystem and also for human communities.
There's a snake fungal disease as well. Is it kind of the same as the BD, or is...
It's a little bit different. The snake disease comes from, I believe it grows on dead materials. It is also a skin disease, so I think there are similarities there. But in general, diseases are emerging at unprecedented rates. And as an ecologist, this is something that is interesting to think about, because these diseases have always been present, but why now are they emerging? Is it this combination of pollutants? Are there shifts in habitat use, susceptibility? And so these are all questions that we're interested in understanding in my lab.
It might be just a combination of all of them.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Which makes it harder to understand.
I'm wondering, does the disease in amphibians and reptiles, is it passed on to other animals that eat them?
As far as we know, for BD in particular, the animals that consume them will think about birds. It's not passed on to our knowledge to birds. It's not passed on to humans. But I think some of the things to think about is oftentimes these amphibians are dying before they're being consumed.
Yeah. Michael emailed to ask what percentage of antibiotics in our waterways come from humans and how much comes from those given to livestock, maybe to stimulate growth in healthy animals?
That's an excellent question. There are many sources of antimicrobial, antibiotic pollution. You get some from the use of, human use that goes through wastewater treatment plants. One of the challenges with a lot of pollutants is that there aren't many ways of removing them from the system. So you have human contributions through hospital effluent, you have contributions through veterinary use, through animal husbandry. So we can think about antibiotics used for cattle that we might take manure and then spread on agricultural areas. We might think about fisheries where we're using antibiotics to allow to keep fish healthy. And so I think the biggest challenge is determining where these antibiotics come from. We know that they are important tools to both human and animal health, but we also don't quite know how they're getting or what percentage is getting into the system. It's hard to track.
Yeah. I was looking at some of your reports and research, and there's evidence that some microbes that are present in wetlands can act as a vaccine, so to speak, against BD in frogs.
That's right.
Tell us more about that. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, we were really excited to study the microbes. Amphibians worldwide are declining. And one of the optimistic aspects of this, my colleagues all around the globe are thinking about ways to protect amphibians from this fungus. And an interesting idea is to use microbes. Microbes growing on the skin, microbes in the water, microbes in the gut. They produce compounds that help them outcompete other microbes, including fungi. And these compounds can reduce the growth of fungi. And so some of my colleagues have suggested that we could use these compounds to treat amphibians that are exposed to this fungus and reduce fungal growth.
Would that involve treating waterways or...?
It hasn't quite moved beyond the conceptual stage because the results have been mixed. But the idea could be you could treat individual amphibians by placing them, removing them from the system, dosing them in a water bath and having that be a good treatment. The other option might be to think about how we might augment the microbial community of a system.
Yeah. You were studying, I think it was free-floating strains of the fungus and yeah, the ones that clump together into sort of like a biofilm.
That's right.
And those two forms affected tadpoles differently.
That's right. What the biofilm form, this is a robust form of the same bacterial species. We worked with the same bacterial species in different forms. One that can be free swimming, living in the aquatic ecosystem. The other one joins with other of the same species to produce a substance that protects the community as a whole from external stresses. And what happens when you have a individual versus a group of microorganisms is that as a group, they can produce different compounds. They are more protected. They outcompete other organisms. And typically, these biofilms have a substance that makes it more robust. So you can think about in your toothbrush, you have those biofilms that form, which are really hard to get rid of.
They are indeed. Jessica Hua, our guest today. She is an associate professor in UW-Madison's Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, studies how ecosystem disturbances like pollution affect ecology and evolutions. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. I want to give a big thanks to everybody who donated during our fall member drive. We had so many people in that fundraising time. Mark and Tomahawk won, Helen and Beloit, Terry and La Crosse. Lots of people help us make this service possible. And if you missed the member drive, there's still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. I actually put mine in. I went in before the fund drive started. I went to WPR.org. It was the first time I've done it that way, and I found out it was not like it took me 1 or 2 minutes to get it done. So if you haven't done it yet, you could still do it at WPR.org. But a big thanks to everybody who helped make the drive very possible and successful. Thanks for helping us keep WPR strong and together. Jess Hua, our guest today, as we talk with her about amphibians and pollution, I guess is one way to describe it. She's doing a lot of research in her lab. And questions about what her research is about, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. What does your research say about how we should really approach treating this? I mean, it's early in the game, I guess, in terms of the research.
Yeah, I think the biggest take-home of this research is we know that these microbes produce compounds that can protect amphibians from this fatal disease. However, when antibiotics are in the system, these exact same microbes, they have to deal with the antibiotics, so they evolve tolerance to the antibiotics. And when they evolve tolerance, they produce a different type of compound that actually enhance that fungal pathogen.
Oh.
So this is incredibly important. The world is such a complex place. If we're going to develop a treatment for this with this pathogen, we have to understand it not in just a benign condition, but our world is contaminated. How might contamination change the potential of a vaccine from something that helps amphibians to something that harms amphibians?
Yeah. Somebody might say, well, why should we worry about amphibians?
Oh, that is a great question. I could talk about amphibians all day, but I'll give you my top three. Amphibians, they play an important role in ecosystems. They provide a lot of food for organisms that many people care about. They are also consuming a lot of organisms that maybe people aren't quite as fond of. Mm-hmm. And you might think about mosquitoes. Amphibians, they live both in the water and on land as they metamorphose, so they carry a lot of nutrients from one place to the next. They play a really important role in just ecosystem functioning. And the last I I'll always think amphibians are neat. There's such a huge diversity of amphibians. They're so interesting. You know, you have some that freeze solid. You have some that change colors. You have some that carry their young on their backs. It's that biodiversity is something that it just should be appreciated. And I think as the world sort of shifts, having that, being in touch with nature, and I think amphibians is one way of having and seeing just cool wildlife.
Well, I just like to hear them.
Oh, not to mention, speaking of hearing amphibians, if people are interested in helping protect amphibians, there are so many opportunities because they call, because they're so easy to identify through their calls. If you care about amphibians and their impact, join some of those community science programs that are out there. Go out and listen. Wisconsin DNR has an amazing program. My lab has an amazing program. There's so much. This is one of those things that there are ways that you can help if you care.
Yeah, there is. And I expect, I don't know how the research dollars are coming, but I'm wondering about more research on this.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been quite frankly difficult. Much of this work is funded by the National Science Foundation, and the National Science Foundation tends to fund basic research, and there's the distinction between basic research and applied research. At least most people think that is the case. However, effective applied research depends on basic research. There's so many instances where basic research has led to phenomenal discoveries that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And so I guess that's another thing that people can do. Help us fight for our science, fight for the next generation of scientists and their training. There's so much going on right now, and there are many ways to do that. You can talk to your politicians. You can support groups on campus. There's, in my own department, Forest and Wildlife Ecology, there's also the long-term research that goes on at the Center for Limnology. There are so many opportunities here that we, as a community, need to come together as the funding landscape shifts.
Gordy and Oliva called to ask how much harm is being done to wildlife by pesticides and herbicides sprayed on cropland and then running off into the wetlands.
That's a great question. With pesticides, it's a very similar story. As contaminants are getting in, you can think about these pesticides having a direct effect on amphibians. So it might be toxic, it might directly reduce amphibian numbers. This is especially important as pesticide spraying sometimes aligns with amphibians when they're the most vulnerable, when they're reproducing, when their young is in the water. It's not just the direct effects, though. There are also indirect effects that are really important. So we don't care just about the large doses of pesticides they get in. At low concentrations, we need to think about how every part of that community is connected. Once these low concentrations of pesticides get in, they can remove other aspects of the community that amphibians depend on. So if an herbicide comes in and kills off the algae that amphibians are consuming, that can have another indirect effect. And these indirect effects often occur at concentrations or amounts of pesticides that are much lower than we expect.
So let's talk for a minute about reducing the amount of antibiotics that end up in our environment, because I think at a personal level, there's probably a lot any of us could do.
Right, right. I think a few things that we can do. There are medical professionals, pharmaceutical professionals that have guidelines for how to properly take antibiotics. Listen to these professionals. Antibiotics work on bacterial infections. A lot of cold are driven by viral infections. So trust your medical providers. Don't take antibiotics when it's not necessary. Use all of your antibiotics. Think about proper ways of disposal when it comes to agricultural use. We can think about practices like making sure that the manure is contained, making sure it doesn't run off into waterways. So a lot of it is just awareness and maintenance. Like I said earlier, antibiotics are important tools to human and wildlife and agricultural livestock health. It's all about being mindful and reducing contamination into our waterways and our environment.
One of your points of importance in your lab is looking at how outreach community science influences community perception and understanding of science.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk about how you're attacking that.
Yeah, we think that a lot of the work that we do in the lab, it's basic science, but what is it worth if we can't communicate it to the people that can use it? And especially in an issue like antibiotic pollution, antimicrobial resistance, this isn't a problem that just affects amphibians. We study amphibians, but this is a human problem. It's a livestock problem, and because of that, because all aspects of this and all components of our society depend on antibiotics, it requires a collaborative approach. We need medical professionals on board. We need farmers. We need scientists. We need science communicators. And I think part of that is learning how to communicate, listen, and learn from each other so that we can come to a solution, because this is an issue that affects all of us.
Jennifer emailed to ask if there are resources or even grants available for landowners to build ponds and or improve creeks that run through their properties.
Oh, I really, really appreciate when there are people that care and want to make a difference. I think the easiest thing to do might be to join up with some of the programs that are already existing. Connect with scientists, connect with educators about building proper ponds. I know that one resource you might think about, we put out this spring, how to improve your habitat, your backyard for mm-hmm. amphibian habitats. There are many of those resources that exist. I think a lot of people in my field would jump at the opportunity to connect with landowners that are interested in this work, community science projects, citizen science mm-hmm. projects. Man, I could go on.
So how do people get a look at what's going on with your lab?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you're interested in the work that we do, thinking about pollutants, diseases, and science communication, check out the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department. You can find me in the faculty page. You could also Google my name, Jessica Hua, and our lab webpage will pop up. If you use social media, Instagram, our handle is Hua Lab_UW, so Hua_lab_UW. And we post a lot of our adventures outside, field work, some of the parasite work, and some of the communication work. So those are three ways you can find me, or you can email me. Always happy to connect.
And your last name is spelled Hua.
That's right. That's right.
So there you go. Kathy emailed, do you have any information about buckthorn on amphibians due to the release of a chemical, emidin, I think it is?
Yeah, so we've done a little bit of research on leaf litter leachates. We compared native and invasive leaf litter, not buckthorn in particular, but in the study what we found is that leaf litter leachates, what that is basically these invasive species will drop their leaves into water. And because the leaf litter chemistry differs from plant to plant, this leachate actually made amphibians more susceptible to road salt, the invasive leaf litter leachate compared to the native. So there's a lot of impacts. And this is just another example of how we try to look at the complexity of nature to better understand what these different pollutants do to amphibians. And again, yeah, we care about these amphibians. There's so many consequences.
You do indeed. And it's fun talking with you again, Jess. We'll talk again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much
for being with us today. Jess Waugh, in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Big thanks to Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins on our team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.